Okay, welcome to the Colorado Secretary of State's office, to the Aspen Room on August 15th. We're holding a public comment opportunity for people to comment on the September 10th recall elections in El Paso and Pueblo County. This meeting will go from 3:30 to 5 today. I'm going to go over a couple of rules of order for our public comment period. First, let me introduce those that are on the panel. I'll start to my right, which is Bo Ortiz. He's the Pueblo County Clerk and Recorder. Hillary Rudy, the Deputy Elections Director. Myself, I'm Judd Choate, the Elections Director for the Colorado Secretary of State's office. Suzanne Steyard, who's the Deputy Secretary for the Colorado Department of State. Wayne Williams, the El Paso County Clerk, and Liz Olson, the Elections Director for El Paso County. Also with us is Steve Ward, who's doing the electronics and making sure that we all run on time here. Some of the mechanics for today. To make comments, you'll need to sign in. So there's a sign-in sheet that we have up here, I think somewhere. And then there's additional ones that are wandering around, I believe. If you do want to comment, and if somebody says something or you hear something that makes you want to comment, just go sign in, and we'll call in order on the sheets. Just want to make sure that we limit the subject matter to those things which are pertinent to this particular meeting, which are the procedures by which we are going to do the recall election. So we won't be taking comments on previous rules that we've sent out that are unrelated to the recall. We won't be taking comments on you know, things related to the lawsuit, which are not all that relevant to the recall procedures. So we're really here just to talk about how the recall will work. But feel free to ask your question, and then we may tell you that that's not all that relevant. We've kind of set up the idea for comments would be that if you have an individual comment, we're going to limit those to about 3 minutes. If you're representing an entity like a political party, we'll give you a little bit more time, maybe up to 5 minutes. If we have time, and it looks like we might, you're welcome to go back to the end of the line. So if you have additional things you'd like to say, feel free to write in again, and we'll get back to you. And then also want you to know that if you have comments that you'd like to make in writing after this is over, we'll hold open the record until 3 p.m. tomorrow. So feel free to write us an email or tell us about things that that came to you after this meeting is complete. There are people listening online, and you're welcome to comment by email. Which email address are we using? State.electiondivision@sos.state.co.us. Feel free to send an email to us at that address, and we'll try to read those comments as we can. On the air, or ask any questions that we receive that way. What do you say? Is that good? I think that covers it. So why don't we go ahead and go to the list of people who would like to make comments? I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, we could do that. Yeah.
Can we do an overview?
Yeah, do you want to do an overview of how we got here?
Yeah, before we get started with public comments, why don't I go ahead and give a quick overview. There are copies by the door, but understanding that everyone just picked them up as you came in, let me just give you a quick overview of what we're looking at and what we're talking about. So the first section is just basically concerning the timeline for verifying any additional candidate petitions that would come in and getting ballot content certified to the counties. So our office would verify the candidate petitions within a business day after the deadline to submit them, and we would certify ballot content to the counties immediately. There would still be the 5-day protest period for those petitions, but we want to get the ballot content in the hands of the counties quickly so they can begin working with their vendors. We also address election notice. Under statute, the deadlines for notice and posting signs would actually happen next week. Counties can't publish election notices until they actually have sample ballot information. So we're adjusting those deadlines accordingly to after we certify the ballot content in that next section. So we also cover, you know, how the notice is posted, posted to the county clerk's website, provided to us for posting to our website. The next section covers registration procedures for the election. Obviously, any voter can register to vote in person at the county clerk's office or at any polling location during the time those are open. But also, we have some provisions in here for processing voter registration. Given the short timeline and the number of folks we may see coming through those locations, we want to ensure that the counties can process as much of the paper that comes to their office as possible before folks start voting. Also, procedures, just recognizing that when we enter a registration application into the SCORE system, SCORE is the statewide voter registration database, that that system performs some checks. It verifies the driver's license number. It takes a look to make sure that the address is a precinctable residential address. So this outlines some of those procedures as well. The next section covers mail ballot procedures. Because of the limited timeline, the counties are unlikely to have their ballots before on or about September 5th. So there are very limited circumstances here for mail ballots, obviously military and overseas voters. There are some confidential voters under the address confidentiality program that must vote by mail, so we cover those folks as well as folks who can't make it in person to the polling place because they, you know, have an illness or a disability or they're absent from their county of residence. So we have some procedures for those folks as well. And then also healthcare facilities, there are procedures in law for the counties to have bipartisan teams of judges with a county representative delivering those ballots. So this walks through those procedures in this mail ballot section as well. The next section is the polling locations. So we're clarifying here that when we say polling location, we're talking about the Voter Service and Polling Center under the new 1303 legislation. And we outline that the counties must open the minimum. We extend deadlines for the accessibility surveys and designating those locations because counties are obviously identifying some additional locations. And then, of course, providing all of the services covered by the Voter Service and Polling Center statutes. And then highlighting that we need to obviously have connectivity at those locations. We address testing and auditing of the voting equipment for the election. Counties need to do a hardware diagnostic and logic and accuracy test of the equipment, but obviously can't do that until they have the ballots printed and available. So we just highlight when those activities have to occur and when we have to get some records from them so that we can identify the equipment that'll be tested in the post-election audit. We also, in the next section, address provisional ballot procedures. So we need to highlight a couple of items for provisional ballots. We're not expecting that we would have a lot, but we want to make sure that we address loss of connectivity to SCORE. Also make sure counties understand what the code is that we'll use there. And then processing and tabulation of those ballots and access to that information. The next section is about election judges. And how the counties are appointing and identifying election judges under the statute, the number of supervisory judges, background checks for judges, all of those sorts of things. And then we also talk about watchers and observers, making sure that we have the same provisions for transparency and openness that we have under the current statute. Watchers, who can appoint a watcher, what watchers can observe, all of those sorts of things. Canvassing and reporting, basically just canvassing under the current statute and reporting on the election night reporting system as early as possible on election night, given that we really are compressing all of the voting into a very short amount of time with in-person voting primarily. So we made some accommodations for getting those results into the main office so that we could get them up on the system. So that is the 3.5-minute overview, the very fast overview.
And with that, we will open up for public comment. The first person on the list is Garrett Reppenhagen.
Hi, Thank you. My name is Garrett Reppenhagen. I'm here on behalf of Vet Voice Foundation, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization. The mission of Vet Voice Foundation is to mobilize veterans to become leaders in our nation's democracy through participation in civic and democratic process. VVF seeks to harness energy and drive dedicated men and women who have fought for their country and put their work at home in their communities on important issues that they face. I'm here today because I believe that we must take every measure possible to ensure that our military service members who are fighting for our country every day overseas are not disenfranchised in the upcoming special recall elections. We are treating military and overseas voters differently because they have to jump through hoops, and this endangers their basic right to vote. While I understand that UCOVA ballots have already been sent, we must make sure that the military voters are properly informed as the possibility of a new ballot, and they are given every opportunity to obtain and vote on the new ballot. This may require some creativity given to the realities of military service. It is also important that every step be taken to protect the integrity and secrecy of their ballots. Suggesting that military members could radio in their desired voting preferences to other military personnel who would then complete their ballot for the individual is not an adequate situation. We have to do better. Presently, COVA voters can return their ballots as long as they are postmarked by 7 p.m. on election day, and they're received within 8 days. Since we are charting new territory with this special election, I urge the Secretary of State to consider other options, such as extending the return date beyond this existing 8 days. Thank you for your consideration of my comments, and please keep active service members in mind when you make critical choices about their upcoming special elections. Thank you.
Thank you. Did anyone on the panel want to comment on that?
This is Suzanne, Deputy Secretary. I just wanted to thank you for your comments. We're certainly mindful of those issues, and we have thought of some creative solutions. We've contacted FedEx to see if we can prepay for postage to come back so that we can ensure that we try to get those ballots back after 8 days. I'm sure you're also aware that we have an online ballot marking system, which I know doesn't work for everyone who's deployed. So we are certainly looking at those creative solutions. If you have any in mind, we would really welcome your comments. You may be more familiar with how the delivery works in the military. So, anything that you can provide us, we would love to hear it in terms of ideas you have to make sure that people get their ballots and get them back, because that is our goal, to make sure that everybody who is deployed overseas has an opportunity to vote and that we count that vote.
Thank you. I just want to reiterate that the secrecy of ballots is very important. The oppression that some service members feel to disclose how they're going to vote is very real, and it's intimidating. So it's very difficult for somebody to vote if they cannot keep it secret. The technology available to many service members overseas is limited. I don't think I saw a fax machine the 365 days I was serving in Iraq, and I was on a decently staffed and equipped base. So whatever creative ways, I'll come up with some comments and leave them on the email.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we had another question.
I'm Wayne Williams, the El Paso County Clerk, and we in El Paso, and I believe Bo also in Pueblo, are both going to work very hard to ensure that every member of the military who is serving has that opportunity to vote in this election. We are reaching out to them via email and by mail for the 93 folks for whom we don't have email addresses. 62 of those are in the U.S., 31 are overseas, and we're going to be contacting them, working to make sure that they have a way of voting and of turning in that ballot. And it's important to note that, as you mentioned, they only have to mail it by Election Day as long as it gets to us. And so that allows them to protect their privacy. Most of them elect to vote instead by email. In the last election, of those who printed out the ballot with the everyone counts, we had 121 who mailed it back, 58 who did fax it, but 996 of them chose to email it. And that's the most prevalent way we receive those ballots back. But we're going to work very hard to make sure that everyone who serves has that opportunity to vote in this election.
Thank you. Look forward to the solutions.
Hillary Jorgensen.
Hi, my name is Hillary Jorgensen. I'm here today on behalf of Colorado Progressive Coalition. We are statewide grassroots advocacy for innovation, and our mission is to work to empower people to have a voice in the decisions that affect their lives. And as part of this mission, we do a lot of election work, and we do a lot of election work around the state. We have 35,000 members around the state, but 15,000 of those members reside in Pueblo. So we do a lot of election work in Pueblo. And we are here today because we have many members who are genuinely excited to participate in this election, but they are very confused about how they are going to do that. And so we would just like to offer a few comments on specifically the center model. I'm going to let Christy introduce herself, and then I will talk about the centers, and Christy will talk about a few other things. Yeah.
And I'll use, they work simultaneously. Perfect. I'm Christy Milligan. I see some familiar faces. I'm the executive director of Citizens Project in the Pikes Peak region, which, among other things, works to promote and protect equal rights and civic engagement. And we, Hillary and I, are both here on behalf of a coalition of organizations across the state to include Colorado Common Cause, Colorado Ethics Watch, Citizens Project, Colorado Progressive Coalition, the Colorado Latino Leadership Advocacy and Research Organization, One Colorado Education Fund, Planned Parenthood Votes Colorado, Mi Familia Vota Education Fund, NARAL Pro-Choice Colorado Foundation, Urban Peak of Colorado Springs, and the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. So really a broad range of statewide organizations. And we're here today. We believe that we have made significant strides in Colorado in increasing access to the ballot box for all people. And that success has been punctuated by the Colorado Voter Access and Modernized Elections Act this year. As you know, this current situation is somewhat unprecedented, and it actually is calling for our clerks to revisit a model of voting that hasn't been used in nearly a decade. And as you also know, there's been an increasing trend toward mail-in vote elections, and the elimination of that is going to potentially result in inconvenience and significant cost for our clerks. We recognize that, as well as some obstacles for voters who are accustomed to voting from the comfort of their homes on their own schedules, many of whom hold multiple jobs or have access transportation barriers. So in the Pikes Peak region in Senate District 11 in 2012, we had almost 33,000 mail vote ballots, and in Senate District 3, we had nearly 42,000. So we're talking about a lot of people who are accustomed to casting their ballots in very different ways. And with that in mind, we come today with some reasonable recommendations that we believe will help you and help voters. We recognize, and know you do too, that the bare minimum is not adequate in this election, and we believe that our recommendations, we have seven quick ones, and we believe that they reflect opportunities for greater efficiency, greater efficacy, and greater voter participation. And Hillary is going to outline those seven, and I'll jump in if I have something to add.
If I can ask a question, do you have a written copy of those for us by chance?
We do.
Can we get that so we can follow along?
Absolutely. So, yes, as Christy said, we totally recognize that the courts have a very difficult job right now. So, really quickly, we wanted to touch on vote service centers versus polling places. So, we really strongly believe that the vote central model should be used for this election. Given the timing of the election and the inconvenience of having to vote in person, as opposed to mail, how many people are used to voting, we think that it's really imperative that clerks use a vote central model. We also really briefly like to touch on the number of vote centers. So, as Christy mentioned, the current calculation or formulation that's in statute is simply inadequate because it really relies on, assumes that a lot of people are going to be voting by mail. And unfortunately, that's just not going to be the case in this election. So, here's just going to give you an idea of some of the math. The plan that was presented in, Kilt on August 5th, Kilt at Passaic County to have 0 vote centers, and Kettler County to have 3, and that they would be open for 5 days. So, here's the unit of math, that's 38 possible voting hours, in the 5 days. In Kettler, that would mean that, Pueblo would have to process 568 votes per hour per site. We are really concerned that that's just not possible. So, our suggestion is either to increase the number of voting centers to 24 in Pueblo and I believe 18 in Pasadena County, or as an alternative, we recognize that any locations can be difficult, especially on a short timeline. An alternative to this is to make sure that the centers that are open are mayor centers, so that they are fully and adequately staffed to handle large volumes of people over the time that they are open. So, I mean, I think the best case scenario is 18 mayor centers are at Pasadena and 24 at Pueblo, but if that's not possible, certainly creating mayor centers is another possibility. I think the next thing we'd like to touch on is equipment and staffing. So ensuring that no matter the number of vote centers, that they are adequately staffed with the equipment and people to be able to handle the large volume that will be coming through.
You are such a wonderful mathematician, but the reality is, you know, you all can see the numbers, and you all are election experts. You know that if everyone voted at an identical rate over the course of the time that things are open, you're going to be looking at handling up to 300 voters per hour at each voting center. And we also recognize, you know, I've been at a polling place all day. I know what it looks like from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Things do not happen with any regularity, and we think that it's absolutely crucial, not just for voters. Obviously, we are here because we are concerned about access for voters, but we're also concerned about you all. We don't have the systems in place to handle everyone showing up who's eligible to vote on election day, at 7 a.m. and at 5 p.m. It's just untenable. And so we have, you can see some numeric recommendations about expanding these numbers that Hillary is so versed in, and I'm not quite as.
Yes, thank you. So I think the next thing that we would like to recommend or talk about are expanded hours for voting. As Christy so eloquently mentioned, not everyone votes at the same rate throughout the day, right? Like, we know that there are peaks, the field work, after work, during lunch. And so to help sort of with the congestion, and also given the fact that people are going to be, have to vote in person as opposed to mail, at the bare minimum, we really believe that polling places, voting centers should be open on 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. to help accommodate people's business interests, you know, so that they can participate in the civic the civic process.
Yeah.
And then the person that's talking about absentee ballots, and we really like to encourage the Secretary of State to adopt the rule, and you've already kind of touched on this, but to allow those who can't vote due to hardship, either disability or illness or something like that, to fill out an absentee ballot. And then, you know, finally, the voter identification requirements. So, if you look in the letter we handed you, there's actually specific language suggestions that are rules that such a state can adopt to avoid confusion about what voter ID is acceptable.
We recognize that this election has everyone scrambling a little bit, and you know, there's new laws this year, and there are a lot of things that hang in the balance. And we hope that you will. I know that Elizabeth will be sending this finalized document along, including all of the co-signers. But we hope that you'll take some of our recommendations into consideration, because we make them with the spirit of not only increasing access for voters, but also for reducing your administrative burden. This is going to be expensive and difficult no matter how we do it, and we should all work together to make it the best possible situation, and we just appreciate. And we'd be remiss if we didn't applaud the efforts that you're already making, it sounds like, around UOCAVA and absentee and trying to get up to speed. So really thank you for your work on that, and looking forward to continuing to work together. Yeah. Hillary, do you have any?
No, just thank you very much. We know that this is not easy for you guys, and you've talked out ahead of you. So thank you so much for what you can do to give some thought to these considerations and these suggestions. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Wayne Williams?
And let me first thank you for giving us the written copy, because that does make it easier to follow along. And I'm just going to quickly go through, and others may want to add on this. First, the rule does contemplate they are voter service and polling centers as contemplated by 1303, so that one's fine. Both Bo and I are looking at increasing the number of voter service and polling centers. So the proposal that was in front of the court was an important word missing from yours is was at least, which is a statutory minimum. But I think both of us believe that additional sites are needed. We are certainly, and I'll let Bo speak to what Pueblo is doing, but we're expanding the size of those. And so that's why our plan now calls for closing some motor vehicle offices, because instead of having a couple counters at a location, we will be taking over the entire location. So certainly with respect to item two, while I may not agree specifically on your numbers, I think both of us recognize that substantial additional things are needed. And the result of that is, with respect to item three, we're also increasing the equipment and staffing that's going to be there. And in fact, I think I know we are reaching out to get assistance from other counties as well. We've had a good response from a number of those. On the hours for voting, these rules actually contemplate an expansion. General rules provide for 4 hours on Saturday. This provides for eight, and I think both Bo and I are planning nine on Saturday, which will allow those who have a job that occupies them during the rest of the time to vote. And I think we're both looking at rather than the required 8 hours during the week, to at least have nine. This rule does address both absentee ballots and UOCAVA, and I think the voter identification requirements are addressed already in the rule as well. So I think we have addressed many of the issues that were here, and I realize, of course, you wrote this without seeing the rule. But I think a lot of the points you raised are important points for us to consider, and I thank you very much for bringing those to our attention.
Thank you, Wayne.
Bo?
And I agree with my fellow clerk over there on most of these points. I think we did find a way to make things work. And in Pueblo, I just wanted to say we're looking at 10 locations. So we're trying to get closer to your number. Most of the challenges that we're having right now are finding, you know, judges to be able to work those amount of times and hours. So what we're looking at is also including that Sunday before the election and being open at all of our locations that Sunday also. We also want to ramp up. So as soon as we get an opportunity to have a ballot or the language for the ballot, we would like to open up as many of those locations as possible using DREs at the beginning. And then as the printed ballots come into our office, going more toward paper as that process is going in. And we understand that it's going to, you know, we're going to see spikes, like you said. We're going to see a lot of people come in at first. And then there's going to probably be a plateau, but there's nothing for us really to gauge this by because it's such a special election. So we are trying to look forward to see that. Paper ballots work a lot faster. We can issue them out and people can sit and vote or stand and vote. And it's a lot faster than DRE voting. So we want to be open at the beginning with DREs and then end strongly with paper ballots toward the end, including DREs at the end. So that's Pueblo's plan. And then I think that's everything. I really appreciate this document and everything that you guys put together in such a short time period to be able to comment. Thank you.
And I actually wanted to add, just because we've spent most of the last 2 days going around and visiting potential sites. The three sites that we will be adding, and each of which are going to be very large sites, are the Zolman Center, where we had a mega polling place for the last election, which is right off I-25 and Circle, the Regional Building Department, which is smack in the middle of the district, and then we have visited with our friends at Manitou, and weather permitting, there will be a voting location also at the Manitou Springs City Hall. So that'll take us from 4 to 7, and each of those are going to be very large sites, much larger than we had envisioned originally for this election.
Great. And the co-signing organizations, please feel free to send us a notice. We're happy to help get the word out about the need for election judges. We know that that's going to be a need, and there's going to be a tight turnaround, and we're happy to help with that.
Yeah, and so you'll send that not just to the Secretary of State, but also to Beau and I as well?
Yes.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your comments.
Jed, if I could, I just wanted to also say thank you very much for including specific language on the ID. I know I've had a couple of conversations with Elena on this, and I appreciate the draft language. We've taken a couple of runs. Please take a look at the draft that we have today, and if you think we could still clarify it, please do let us know that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I got a request. Can you post this online
yeah.
right now?
So I don't. Has it been posted now? Do we know?
Posting is pending. Andrew is working on it.
Okay.
So it should be posted momentarily.
So for those of you that are listening, if you go to our website, it'll probably be under elections. The document that we circulated in the room and discussed early on will be posted.
It's on the rulemaking.
It's on the rulemaking page. So if you go to elections and click rulemaking and statutes, it'll be under the rulemaking. And it's not there yet, but it will be. And also, we are receiving comments through email. And so I wanted to bring up one that we've gotten. We've actually received several comments from Marilyn Marks, who often will comment on our various rulemaking and public comment periods. And she has asked us to clarify what each county is going to do to make sure that people cannot move into the county immediately prior to the election, register in that county, and then vote and leave that county. So would either of you like to jump in and discuss that issue? Either of the county officials?
So we've established a pattern here, so I'll take the first stab at this and let Mike. Colleague from further south at I-25 take over. We have been working with the Secretary of State's office with respect to these issues and gotten from them some very specific guidance. And let me pull up. I'm not as fast on this as my daughter is. Okay, so I want to make sure that folks recognize that under existing provisions of Colorado law, and this is in section 12204, an individual is required to give his place of residence, his or her place of residence, and to affirm the answers. And significantly, these statements are made under penalty of perjury or a class six felony. And one of the things that's worth noting in here is the individual, I'm trying to find the, 12204-1A, whether the elector intends to claim the elector's present address as the elector's sole legal place of residence, and in so doing to abandon claim to any other legal residence. And so it is our intent when we receive information, whether it's mail coming back or other information indicating the person does not actually live at the address they gave, that we will prosecute that, we'll refer it to the district attorney, and we'll actively investigate and prosecute any wrongdoing that does occur here. 1303 contemplates a prosecute afterwards as opposed to a prevent, but we intend very strongly to be involved in that prosecution. We had a similar issue with respect to looting in after the Waldo Canyon fire, and our district attorney prosecuted the couple people who looted, and they're spending, I think, the next 30 to 40 years in jail as a result. And the result of that is, during the Black Forest fire, there was a lot less effort at that. And so we intend to send the message in El Paso County that if you do break the law, that we do intend to prosecute. And so that's what we plan on doing in terms of preventing it. And I'll turn it over to my colleague.
In Pueblo County, it's a very similar process that we're going through. We're working with the DA's office right now on ways that we can track any of these voters that are possibly looking for ways or loopholes to exploit in the law. We don't believe that there's going to be any significant amount of people interested in doing that in any given election. If somebody would want to do this, they would be tracked and prosecuted according to the law, and we will look to our DA's office for some guidance on how they intend to investigate those potential issues. And we were looking directly at the score system and looking at reports within the score system to be able to track any of those issues that pop up if they do, and which I don't think they will. And I don't believe that it was 1303 that created this issue. I think that this issue was in place in Title I before 1303, and so we look forward to working with the DA's office in Pueblo County and making sure that our electorate and our voters in our county are sure that all votes are counted and that everybody is given the proper access to voting in Pueblo County. So that's all I have to say.
And this is Suzanne Steyert. The Secretary's office also on, I think it was on Monday, published a temporary rule that we haven't adopted yet, but put it out for comment regarding this issue of people coming into the county and then potentially leaving the county. And what we did in the rule was sort of cobble together some of the statutes that Clerk Williams has talked about in specifying clearly in the rule what we think already exists in law, but sort of putting all those together so that people have some certainty as to how we intend to do the best we can to prevent this. And this issue did exist before 1303, except that the main difference is that with the cutoff period for registration moving up, prior to 1303, we would send a postcard to those addresses if somebody registered at an address, and then that would be the confirmation card to do some check on the actual address. With same-day registration, that period of time is obviously not there, so there won't be a confirmation card going out, but the rule will attempt to put all of these affirmations together to ensure that voters understand that if they come and they register, that they must affirm that they intend to make this their permanent residence. And as the clerks have both talked about, anybody who violates that rule would be subject to felony prosecution.
All right, thank you. Ms. Marks also has another question which relates to the use of DREs. Do either county, in addition to the requirement under HAVA, does either county plan to rely on DREs, or will they be issuing paper ballots?
I'll take one first. we plan on using both DREs and paper ballots in all our polling locations. And like I stated earlier, we intend to start off primarily electronic until we can get the ballots printed from our printer and in our offices. And then after that, we're going to primarily be paper ballot locations.
And our plan in El Paso County is to start all of them off as paper ballot locations. DREs will be available both for those to whom they're required by law, but also for others who wish to vote in that method. But we intend to use primarily paper ballots.
Okay, the next testimony from Jeff Orrock.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Orrock. I am the state chair for the Libertarian Party of Colorado. I guess the angle that I would like to discuss is, I noticed there's language talking about how there are requirements to maintain a bipartisan parity in terms of election judges and a few other functions in terms of the conduct of the election. And of course, I know that there are some people who wish that there were only two parties. However, there are at least three other political parties in the state, not to mention the fact that one-third of the population has eschewed the party system altogether and chosen to register as unaffiliated. So the question is, how do people, voters, or who are not affiliated with Democratic or Republican parties going to be accommodated in terms of being election judges, in terms of being watchers? And I guess a side note on the watcher thing is that, you know, I know that last year during the election there was occasionally some friction, possibly antagonism, between some of the clerks. I don't believe in either of these two counties, but in other counties there was some antagonism between the clerks and the clerk staff and watchers who wanted to be able to ensure that they had transparent access to the entire process. And then to go even further to the Canvas board, by an interesting fluke, of course, thanks to Mr. Tancredo, the Constitution Party did, for the first time in history, get to participate in the Canvas boards. And so they were able to put a few people here and there. Of course, their numbers are small, so they didn't have as full representation, but still they were able to weigh in and have a say in terms of making sure that there was a suitable audit for all of the different processes involved in collecting ballots, counting ballots, and tallying the results. So I would like to, I would like to know what kind of plans there may be or what kind of accommodation can be provided in terms of allowing other interested parties or organizations or, the mass of unaffiliated voters, how they may be able to participate, since as most of us are probably familiar with the Lenin quote, it doesn't really matter who votes, it matters who counts the votes. And I don't want to impugn anybody's character here, I certainly don't mean that, but I do believe that it is vital for us to maintain transparency in all of the areas of this election.
This is Suzanne again. I mean, not to get too technical on the watcher side, but certainly any candidate has an opportunity to appoint a watcher. So if the Libertarians are running a candidate in the recall, they can have a watcher appointed that way. A recall is technically a not an, the recall question itself is not an election of a candidate, and so any issue committee can appoint a registered issue committee as specified in this rule can appoint a watcher, and I believe there's up to six that are currently registered, both for and against the recall. So there is a lot of opportunity to participate outside of being a member of one of the two major parties. Now that is mostly outlined in the statute. So, you know, our ability to say you will appoint X number of Libertarian judges is already limited by what exists in the statute, but I'm sure the clerks can speak to their ability to try to accommodate some of those other issues. But as to the watchers, I don't believe there's any necessarily favoritism toward the major parties.
For those following along on the rules, this is on page 8, lines 6 through 9. Which does specifically provide that a major or minor political party with a candidate on the ballot, an unaffiliated candidate who's on the ballot, or a registered issue committee supporting or opposing the recall question may appoint one or more watchers to observe election activities. So the first response I'd make is to the extent you have a candidate on the ballot, you certainly have the ability to do that. A number of organizations have also organized campaigns for or against, and each of them have that to the extent they've registered as required by law. The other note I would have is that at least in El Paso County, many of our processes at our main office have large windows open to the public hallway that anyone and everyone can come watch and observe. And so beyond the official watchers, because we built our site recently, we were able to build it in a fashion to open up that public access and transparency. And so those are some of the steps that we're taking in El Paso County.
Do you mind if I can? So if I am a watcher and I'm behind glass, how far away am I? I mean, can I actually see anything happening, or can I just see people, you know, figures moving around, you know?
First, if you are a watcher, as in a formally appointed watcher, you can actually come in. And so you can be, I think it's 6 feet away, is that my? I don't know,
closer,
depending on what's necessary and what works. And so for a formal watcher, you can come in, and for individuals watching from the hallway, there are a number of activities that take place relatively close. Some of them are further away, and so it's as good as access as we can provide given the space, the constraints of the space. But for formally appointed watchers, they're actually in the room with the folks. They're not in the hallway.
Unfortunately, we haven't built our facility recently. We are very limited in Pueblo County as far as space goes and watcher space. And from what I heard earlier, according to this rule, there's going to be quite a few watchers that are going to be official watchers that go through the official part of it. So it's going to be very difficult for us to fit any extra people into certain parts of this election. But we will follow the statute and the rules that are both voted into law and promulgated by the Secretary of State's office. As far as judges go, we try to fill in where we can with independent or unaffiliated or minor party judges where we can. I think, as required by this rule and by statute, that we have to take the list from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and use as many of those as judges in our locations. So,
Can you clarify the percentage, roughly, of non-Democratic and non-Republican?
I wouldn't know because we are barely in the hiring process, and Becky Mizell, who's the chair of the Republican Party, is helping us develop lists, and we're working with Ron Greenwell and the Democratic Party to develop lists also. So I couldn't give you a percentage of how many people will be unaffiliated until after I've done the hiring.
It seems like after the fact. So, oh, too late, we're done hiring. Yes?
Well, any unaffiliated voter can come in and apply at any time
okay.
to become a judge in our county, and we would you know, we, like I said, is where we can, we will fit them into our process.
Okay, I think that's all I can think of at the moment.
Thank you. Our next person to testify just happens to be Becky Mizell.
Good afternoon, everyone. Becky Mizell from Pueblo County Republican Party. This is just more comments and observations, and I do want to thank Mr. Ortiz. You have had more election meetings for both parties, which I really appreciate, having more communication this election cycle for this very important recall. I would like to clarify also, again, on 32.7 watchers and observers. We do have a two-floor election department in Pueblo County. Last election cycle, we were allowed one watcher for the whole department until the end of the election, where we were allowed two, which is not adequate to see the processes going on within the election department. And Mr. Ortiz did say that he would be enforcing the six-foot rule, again, where, of course, you cannot really observe what's going on with 6 feet. So I assume we're going to be looking at Section D on access to what is going on in the election department. So that's my comment on watchers. And also, if one watcher or one, we would have to know clarification on how many we're allowed to have this time and clarification on that six-foot rule. Number two, judges. Mr. Ortiz has let the parties assign judges this time, which we appreciate, but we would also talk about where judges are placed, and the parties should have access to where judges are placed and have input as to where our judges should be placed. DRE machines is our third concern and comment. The DRE machines classically are located in the election department in kind of a closet space, and the video cameras are only in the hallway, not inside the DRE space. And we express concerns about the video surveillance security by not having direct surveillance of the DRE machines. And we would like that clarified before this recall election. My fourth comment is on roving election teams. Roving election teams, my past is an elder advocate, so I really do understand the needs of the elderly and them having access to voting. But we were talking about roving election teams going around the county and how that would be appointed and who would determine who the disenfranchised voters are and who would make that determination.
I'll comment. This is Suzanne again. A couple of things. There's not a six-foot rule on watchers. I mean, watchers can witness and verify, but that also has to be done in a way that's not disruptive to the election.
Right.
And so you're familiar, obviously, with the Pueblo, you know, the two-floor system. And
right.
For those who aren't, there's a floor downstairs that's separately locked that's a very tight space,
right,
where the tabulation is going on. I would say tight enough that maybe two watchers could stand there and be semi-comfortable. You can't even fit a chair, if I remember right. I don't know how much tabulation is going to be going on down there this time. It doesn't sound like a lot. So it may be a very different experience for the watchers. Because there's not going to be, you know, a lot of signature verification going on because we're not going to have mail ballots. So I think the experience, you know, may be better because you won't be in a crowded room watching activities, you know, happen very quickly. But
my concern was most the first floor with us having one observer, one watcher in the first floor space, which is very, very large, and a lot of activity goes on in the different parts of that
right.
First floor.
I think what you're talking about is the second floor.
Yeah, the second floor. The first floor is the tiny
yes.
little closet, basically.
Second floor first, yeah, exactly.
You know, so I think it may be a better experience. But, you know, one thing that we've talked about is when we say, you know, everybody can appoint a watcher, I mean, let's say that you had 12 watchers, you know, for the different, let's say you had one, each candidate had one, and each issue committee had one, and there were eight there. You couldn't fit eight people in that room downstairs. So, you know, we would have to get together and everybody would have to be willing to accommodate what, you know, Clerk Ortiz is going to have to deal with, which is, you know, agreeing that you're going to rotate or something like that. So, you know, I think as long as, you know, nobody gets, you know, on an extreme, right. we'll probably
really
be fine.
My concern is really the second floor.
Yeah, but even the second floor this time around, I don't know how much activity is going to be going on.
But one watcher, and this is different because it will be a polling place election, but...
Yeah, we're fine with one watcher per activity.
Right.
So,
we didn't have that
you know,
last time.
And so we're, you know, we're mindful okay. of that, that, you know, some have huge rooms with different activities going on in different spaces. But again, I don't think you're going to see an election like that this time.
Correct.
Because we're not going to have ballots being opened and, you know, all those kinds of things. So, you know, certainly we're happy to try to help with that. As far as placement of judges go, you know, we agree that the parties appoint the judges. But in terms of, you know, dictating where a judge works, you know, I think Clerk Williams would tell you that I think he's thinking about instituting a kind of computer knowledge for certain activities in the clerk's office because, you know, you can't place, you can't tell a clerk you must use this judge to be doing data entry if they're not proficient at data entry.
Correct.
So, and I'll let Clerk Ortiz speak to that, but you know, so I think as long as you're working together and you know you're being collaborative about it, that's fine. But I don't think the Secretary's office is going to support actually telling a clerk where they have to put somebody. Now, if it's you know if you feel like you know you're not getting anywhere, you know that's a different issue. But I think that he'll be accommodating to a point, but you can't expect that
no,
that you're going to make his schedule
with judges
for him.
This okay. time around.
All right.
Mm-hmm. I think Suzanne said a lot there, and we appreciate the Secretary of State's position on all those issues. And I think that this document talks a lot about it and changes parts of that rule so that watchers will have more access. We talked about it during the meeting earlier. And so, you know, even though it's not accommodating to me because it's very tough for me to imagine people in one of my election counting areas according to the new rule. But, you know, we're going to make it work and we'll work with you very closely. And like I've said before, you know, this is going to be an open dialogue between us and the parties. And we're going to do whatever we can to accommodate you on all those issues that you come to us with. So.
Great, thank you. The DRE question, I'm still going to leave on the table, and the roving election teams. A bit more clarification on what will constitute roving election teams?
Well, we're talking about the healthcare facility issue and possibly, so I don't know if you want to explain that in a little bit more detail.
Sure, this is Hillary. So in terms of healthcare facilities, there's a process pretty well set out in statute for delivery and return of ballots to healthcare facilities by bipartisan team of election judges and a representative from the county clerk's office. And so the counties will be following that statute in terms of delivering ballots to residents at those facilities. And the statutory framework is that it's a healthcare facility that's a nursing home, a long-term care facility, facility for individuals with disabilities, those types of facilities, and they're specifically laid out in statute, and that there are more than 7 ballots that would be delivered there, and that there are not individual mailboxes. So there's a pretty clear process in statute, and then we are anticipating in the rule that if there are facilities that have fewer ballots that would be delivered or they don't have central mail delivery, that the clerk could still send a team to those locations as well to expedite delivery of ballots to those folks. So I think there's a pretty strong statutory.
So we're talking healthcare facilities, which I totally recognize, not just individuals who might be homebound.
That was
discussed earlier.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you there. We are also expanding that option to individuals who are homebound. So if they don't have access to fax or email, or they don't have somebody that they could designate as an authorized representative to pick up a ballot for them, and they can't physically get to the polling location to vote, they can request that that team of judges deliver the ballot to them. So we would extend that to folks who simply have no other option of getting a ballot.
If I can interrupt for just a second, just so folks can see the rules we're talking about, the emergency balloting is on page 4, item D, and the HCF, which are the healthcare voters, are on page 5, item E, just so you can see the rules that we're talking about.
And as far as that goes, too, we are open to having possibly a watcher accompany them. Obviously, we couldn't have eight watchers accompanying them.
No.
But right. we're also, and I think we worked with you last time with that, so
yes.
we would allow that also. And then about the DREs, I'm sorry, can you restate that question?
The DRE machines are located inside kind of a closet location, and you and I discussed it many times, and you even said you didn't think they were properly camered. Can we get the camera so it's on the DRE machines, not in the hallway outside of the DRE machines?
Now, to clarify, I think they're properly camered according to the rule, the security rule. What we would like to do, and because that door is covered, we can see anytime anybody goes in and out of that location, and it's so tight in there. Basically, all the DRE machines are stacked onto each other and daisy chained. There's enough room. It's a closet, is what it is, and there's 104 DRE machines in there. So even if you tried to open a DRE machine in that location, you couldn't do it. So we are trying to figure out a way to camera it better, but the problem is also if we pick a corner for the camera, it's going to pick up one side of it, and we only have so many slots for camera hookups in our system.
Right.
So we're looking at a new system to do that, but in the time frame that we're talking about with the special election, I'm not sure that I'm going to have that done in time. But any work that is done on the DREs is done on camera. I just want to clarify that.
Are you pulling the DRE machines out
yes,
to work
we are.
On them then? But you,
we can't work on them in that room inside. Because you can't open one up. And
oh, really? Okay. All right.
Thank you very much. I have been informed that the document that we've been looking at here in the room is now available online. So if you go under rulemaking, so if you go to the Secretary of State's office, and you go to elections, and then statutes and rulemaking, and you click the public hearing that is happening today on August 15th. At the bottom of that, there's a link to the working draft that we've been discussing. So the next person on our list is Mark Gruska.
Mark Gruskin, it's like old home week with some of you. I have questions as much as anything about a number of the rules, and I'm hoping that there can either be clarity provided here or clarity provided in the rules. On page 2, 32.7.3A, an elector may register in person. I assume that's taken to mean that there's authority and that any person who's qualified can, in fact, register. And the reason that comes up is B. The B refers to processing through September 4th, and then it says the county may process voter registration applications received after that date. Is it the anticipation that if there is not processing of voter registration applications that those people will still receive a provisional ballot or otherwise be entitled to vote, or that if the county chooses not to deal with voter registration applications after that date, that person will be rejected from going to the polls?
This is Hillary. So the intent of A is, in fact, that eligible individuals can register in person at the locations. We should probably go ahead and add that term in there. The intent of B is to extend the processing of all other applications. So currently, after the passage of House Bill 1303, there is a 22-day cutoff and an 8-day cutoff. 22 days for applications received by mail and through voter registration drives or voter registration agencies, and 8-day for online. And what the intent of B is to extend that cutoff period for processing so that we can process, or the counties rather can process, as many applications as possible before voting begins so that we can reduce the amount of folks who might be waiting in the registration line at the polling locations and actually get people into the voting line. So that's the intent of A and B. If you have ideas for clarifying that in the actual rule, we would definitely be interested in hearing that.
Well, why wouldn't the county I understand that there are existing timelines, but this is all about evidently displacing legislative judgments. So why wouldn't the county process those voter registrations received after September 4th?
Well, registrations received in the polling locations obviously would be processed at the polling locations. So what we're talking about are applications that come in the mail or through the online system once the polling locations are open. And really, it's just a practical ability for the counties to allocate their staff to the polling locations where folks are showing up in person. If they need to put their staff at all of those locations rather than process what's coming in the mail, we just want to make sure that they are able to do that. So it's just a practical consideration that at some point we've got to deal with the voters standing in front of us at the polling location.
Well, I understand that, but there's no specific authority or clarity about what capacity that individual has and what hoops they have to jump through. Do they have to register at the polls then? So you are actually saying that someone who has submitted a voter registration form that you have not processed needs to re-register on the day that he or she decides to vote?
I think that's correct, and I think that House Bill 1303 actually cuts that off much earlier. If you, under House Bill 1303, registered vote or submitted your registration application, say, 15 days before the election, that application would be deferred until after the election. So if you went in person to the voter service and polling center, you would, in fact, need to go ahead and complete a registration application at the voter service and polling center.
It doesn't trigger a provisional, though. I mean, the fact that you've registered before, you'll just have to, you're right, register again, basically, and then when they go back in and see that you're already there, if there's no corrections, then it'll just be noted as a new, as a change, or, but there won't be provisionals.
And what sort of ID requirements are then required for the person who will be re-registering at the polls?
Same as in statute. Okay. So anything that is that you can vote with in person will
any of
be
the
accepted.
19 forms of
19, are there 19?
I don't know. Okay. I made that number up. Right. Actually, someone said it was 19.
Okay.
I went for the bait. Also on page 2 under D3, second sentence states the elector must affirm that the elector has resided and will continue to reside at the residential address provided on his or her application. Continue through what period? Continue through, I mean, what does that mean? It's actually a question. It's not a crack. It's just, what does that mean?
I think the idea of that is that it's the residence going forward. So it's not the residence for that day, but it's a residence which will continue. Okay. And it doesn't need to be a particular amount of time.
Okay.
It just needs to be that person believes right there at that moment, and they affirm that they will continue to reside in that location going forward.
Well, and to cite 12204-1A, I think the intent here is, intends to claim the elector's present address as the elector's sole legal place of residence, and in so doing, to abandon claim to any other legal residence, and that's what we're looking for here.
And that's the typical definition, the intent to reside and the intent to return there as your permanent abode, even if you aren't there at the moment. But I just want to make sure that that issue is going to be applied evenly. Let me just refer you to page 3 under 32.7.4A3 allows eligible electors to receive ballots in recall elections if they timely submit an emergency mail ballot application. Presumably that's any elector who satisfies the conditions for an emergency mail ballot, correct? Okay. My next questions deal with what is under B, military and overseas voters. Number 3 says, in essence, if if you have received a ballot and don't have the, in essence, the final ballot, you can vote, and all of your votes will be counted. I assume that means the top half of the ballot and the bottom half of the ballot, correct? The recall question as well as the candidate choice. And I would just note for the record that there's a lot of nodding going around, so I'm going to take that for a yes.
Yes.
Excellent. And I assume likewise that under, on page 4, Roman numeral 4-2, where you say if a military overseas voter returns only the first issued ballot, the county must count both the recall question and the candidate race. What that means is even if you don't have full choice among the candidates who petition on, that the ballot that you cast is counted for the candidate that exists on the ballot that's already been mailed out, the first mailed ballot.
Yes, and there is, although I don't necessarily agree with the question as phrased, Councillor, which is there is a write-in slot, and so there is that full choice for anyone to write in whomever they wish. It may not be printed, but that individual on the 645 ballots that El Paso County sent out and the couple hundred that Pueblo, I forget your exact number, 279 that Pueblo sent out, on all of those ballots, there is an opportunity for an individual to write in, right? Yours has the two. Yep. Okay. Yes, there is that individual, so there is that full choice. It's just not as easy as when it's printed for you.
I understand, and I wasn't trying to tilt the question. I was just asking whether or not
it will count.
Because, frankly, you'll recall at trial, the proposal that you made was – the proposal that El Paso County had developed by August 11th was that only the top half of the ballot would be counted.
It was a work in progress.
And I appreciate that, and I understand that, and I'm just trying to make sure that, you know, my memory, as clouded as it is from that delightful Monday, somehow doesn't carry over to this document.
You are correct that we continue to take comments, and the Secretary has issued this, and we support.
Okay. Let me go a little bit further up the page, and I'm really not trying to, I hope we're, I'm not dominating. If there's a problem with time, just say so. But Roman numeral 3, I think this one is important. County sends ballot to military and overseas voters by mail or electronic transmission as requested by the elector. Can you tell me exactly how that request process is going to work?
The request was made at the time the individual submitted the application to become a UACAVA voter.
So it will be that designation as opposed to any other
correct
process.
Now, we are in El Paso County giving, first of all, in addition to the electronic transmission, we also mail. So we actually send them two ways. But in El Paso County, we are contacting the 93 UACAVA voters who have not elected to provide us with an email to give them the opportunity to do that as well. But it's important to note, however they receive the ballot, they can still choose how they return it. So they can mail it back, and as long as it's postmarked by Election Day and received within 8 days thereafter, it counts. Or they can email it, or they can fax. Okay.
But the designation happens at the front end, and to the extent that you contact them and you're able to have some supplemental contact, that's an additional process.
It is the voter's choice.
Got it. The before I leave, and I'm sure that this was inadvertent, but under Roman numeral 4, my guess is that you probably meant except for verifying the elector's signatures, as opposed to just verify. And I understand that these are works in progress, to quote Clerk Williams. And then my last comment is on page 5. At the bottom, voter check-in polling locations. Each polling location must include an adequately staffed check-in table. Now, that's a lofty goal, and I understand kind of, I think, what you're trying to get to, but do we know what that means?
No.
Okay.
Bluntly, we have never conducted an election in Colorado with same-day voter registration. And so this is a whole new process. I think for us, we are anticipating a significantly larger number of judges under these procedures, as I mentioned earlier. But predicting folks and their habits of which of the various, one of the downside of the voter center model is you don't know where people are going to go. And so I think Arapahoe County this last year experienced everyone going to one location where there were lines and no one going to another location. Certainly for us during early voting, we shifted people and resources as it became apparent that some sites were more popular than others. And so I think you have correctly pointed out that this is in some sense an aspirational goal that's not clearly defined because we don't know. We could have a site at which two voters go to, and we could have a site at which thousands go to every hour, and so we'll adjust staffing as we go forward.
Right. Can I address that too?
And let me just say what that was getting to. We were trying to have a check-in table where that was separate from what you're used to walking into, because this would be somebody more like a guide who would find out, are you registered? Because we want to move the people who are already registered right into the voting and then move the people who are there to do same-day registration to a different line. So this is more like a greeter, if you will, that is sort of like you belong. Yeah, you're over here, you're over here. So when we say adequately staffed, I think the reason we use that word is that this had come out of our general rulemaking, and some of the feedback we got from the counties is that, you know, in certain areas, we're not going to have a separate table. You know, we might not have a separate person there. We might be able to staff it just with the same person who is doing same-day registration because there's not a line going out the door or whatever. And so we were trying to provide some guidance that, you know, we want people in and out as quickly as possible. So the adequate word shouldn't, I think, alarm you in the sense that we're, you know.
I think it's exactly okay. The right message to send. And I'm glad it's in there. I mean, I'm not, because frankly, the bottleneck, if it occurs, happens at the front end of the process. And so I think it's precisely the right message to send. I just didn't know if it had a particularized meaning or whether or not it was just kind of setting an objective that would, as Clerk Williams suggests, might float based upon the time of day or the location of the place.
And I just want to state that in Pueblo County, what we're doing right now is working with the GIS department. And we're comparing where people work and their densities of work locations compared to the populations of where they live, because we feel like they're probably going to vote at where they work and where the jobs are in those densities. So we're trying to put the smaller centers out in the county areas where people may live, but they're commuting into the city of Pueblo to do both business and shopping. So, and those are going to be where the larger locations are. So some of our locations are going to have probably 20, 25 people working at the, or judges at those locations. I'm sorry, 26 people. We need to have even numbers. And some of them are going to have smaller numbers, maybe 8 people working at those locations, and then we're going to be able to move people around as needed. So.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. I have no one else listed, but I have a couple of other comments from email. If you want to come back up for another run, or if you have a question that's popped up, feel free to jot down your intent to testify, and I'll go through a couple more of the written comments. These are all from Marilyn Marks, so we have a couple in a row from her. She's asked if we in the rule have contemplated appointing judges from neighboring counties to help in case there's a need for additional judges. That is contemplated, and in fact, in the rule, we go one step further and also put the possibility that the Department of State staff could serve in that role as well. So that's indicated in the contemplated rules. Another thing that she's requesting is clarification on the requirement under the existing statute that when the party appoints judges or has the list of judges, that the party can prioritize that list, and the counties need to, as best they can, keep to that list of priorities. I actually think in this particular circumstance, that's probably not going to be all that relevant, because we're going to need a lot of judges fast. And so those people that clear the background check are likely going to get appointed, unless there's some serious issue. And I suspect that that's going to be not very common. So those were the two issues she had related to judges. Does anybody want to comment on the judges issues? And then the last thing she asked was about watchers. She just wanted to clarify that do the candidates have a right to watchers? And I think our reading of the statute in this particular circumstance is that no, they don't, but the parties they represent do. But if they're an unaffiliated candidate, they do. So if you're a Democrat successor candidate, the Democratic Party would select the watchers that would correspond to your candidacy. Same with the Republicans, the Libertarians, any other party. But if you were unaffiliated, then that candidate would have the choice of watchers.
And just to explain a little bit how that works, if since it's a free-for-all now in terms of who submits petitions, if six Republican candidates all submit petitions to run as successor candidates and 15 Democratic candidates are on there, the party has only one watcher for each of the sites that they get, each of the activities that they get to appoint, and so it is narrowed down for that. And I think in part, the watcher rule mainly kicks in during general elections. So if you contemplate a general election at which the Republican Democratic Party, the ACP, each might have 30 different candidates on the ballot, each of those do not get to make their own appointment, and the party chooses someone, and so that candidate needs to work with their party if they believe they have particular individuals they wish to be watchers, or with an issue committee.
And I just want to clarify, there is no candidate, correct, on the recall? It's an incumbent who is being recalled, and then the successors. Right. So the successors are allowed a watcher.
By party.
Okay.
Unless they're unaffiliated. If they're unaffiliated, then they get to pick their own watcher. I have no additional comments, and I have no additional, but perhaps we have one. So why don't you come up and join us? And when you're done, could you sign one of our sign-up sheets so that we have your info?
Elizabeth Steele, Colorado Common Cause. I have one question. I just want to clarify whether either county is planning to use ballot on demand.
We intend to use ballot on demand to a certain extent, but we are contemplating in this instance using pre-printed ballots, but if we begin to run out, we will print additional ballots as necessary. We will be using our ballot on demand printers to print the Uecava ballots and other things that go out in that fashion. But in terms of the actual polling places, we hope to have pre-printed ballots, in part because the ballot's the same for everybody. That's different than the last general election, in which there were
hundreds of ballot styles.
Yeah, I forget the exact number.
There were 44 different styles.
44 different styles in the last one with 199 precincts, so you correlate those two, and it became important to do it differently. But in this case...
So you would anticipate ballot on demand being necessary at a particular location if that location ran out of ballots?
We'd probably be doing it from our central site and then transporting those out to the, and we wouldn't wait till they ran out. We would
I got
hopefully have judges who will remember to tell us and say, hey, you're getting low.
No, I'm sure. I wasn't trying to imply that. And are you going to use ballot on demand?
We're planning on using ballot on demand both for UOCAVA, probably HCF voters and emergency voters in office. So I think those three we are going to do, and then to supplement whatever polling places are being, you know, they might have, maybe we have, you know what, I'm not going to say that. I just think those are the issues that we're going to use it the most for.
Okay. Thank you.
And in that scant time, we've received another comment from Marilyn Marks, so let me throw that out real fast. Marilyn would like to know, will the ballots be counted on precinct machines or at central count? And then also, will counting progress daily, or will it happen all after vote close on Tuesday the 10th?
So we will not tally any votes until after 7 p.m. on election night. We do not have mail ballots coming in, so I don't foresee using the central count scanner that we use for mail ballots. So we believe that we will be using our Insights and our Edges, which are Insights are polling place paper ballot counting machines, and our DREs, which are the direct recording electronic machines, and they will not be tabulated until after 7 p.m. on election night.
Like Pueblo, El Paso intends at this point to have the tabulations conducted at, or have the machines counting the ballots as they come in, and then pulling the tabulation reports on election day.
Great. One more request has been made to identify on our website where you can find the draft rules. Those can be found, that's much easier, we've got a better way to get there now, on the front page of the website, so literally the SOS homepage. If you go under News, which is the second box on the front page, under August 14th, there's notice of this public meeting, and then if you click that, at the bottom of that, it has a section called Draft Rules, and you can click the current version of the draft rules. So it's one click on the news on the August 14th announcement of this public meeting, and then to the bottom of that page. Okay. We have one more. I know that guy. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. Jack Earlsmith, Douglas County Clerk and Recorder. I fully anticipated being a observer, but I would like to make a comment to the Secretary of State's office. I know as I hear this, I become horrified thinking, you know, what would happen if this was Douglas County? I know that the Secretary has said that he was not paying for this election, and I understand that, but I would urge the Secretary's office to maybe be creative in thinking about this. Maybe there can be a grant process from the counties who could apply for some assistance, because we are coming to the end of the county budgetary year. We have not run the 2013 election yet. If my fellow clerks are anything like Douglas County, we're cutting it close. So I would hope that there might be some way to assist those counties. Thank you.
Can I comment?
Then I'll take it. Yeah.
I wholly disagree with that.
Jack, I could kiss you right now. I completely agree, and I think if we look back in history of elections, there was a recall for a district attorney in 2005, where Gigi Dennis's decision to ask for a supplemental to the JBC in order to refund the counties that participated in the recall. So I think there have been attempts at reimbursement also, and we would appreciate anything that the Secretary of State's office can do to help Pueblo County and El Paso County find that reimbursement, and if they can go back to those letters that were sent out by Gigi in 2005, who was the secretary at the time, and maybe look at how wise she was in her decision to do that. We would appreciate it.
Hey, Bo, do you remember whether or not that was granted? Did the JBC?
I do. The JBC did turn down the supplemental request, but I think that this JBC is different and made up differently than the one in 2005. So I optimistically think that we have a shot at getting that supplemental. So,
On behalf of El Paso County, who asked this question way back in, I think, May it was, and got told no by the Attorney General's office and Secretary of State's office, we would join in with our friends in Douglas and Pueblo with the request to at least consider that as a possible supplement to the JBC. They may say no. But I think any time you were dealing with a state office, there are significant impacts. And I think particularly if you look at what might happen in circumstances where there was, where there might be a statewide recall election that has significant impact. Some other counties may not have the ability of a larger county like Pueblo and El Paso County. And so I think it is worth looking at, both for this as a special supplement and for also examining whether a clarification of the statute might be appropriate. I would also note, since Jack came up here, that Jack Arrowsmith, clerk of Douglas County, and other clerks have all been very helpful to both Bo and I in offering assistance. It's one of the reasons why we clarify in the rule they don't have to be an employee of that county, because both of our counties may employ some folks from elsewhere in the state to assist. And so I just want to express my appreciation and our appreciation in El Paso County for the assistance from both from other counties and from the Secretary of State's office on these issues. So thank you.
And I would like to echo Wayne Williams and how he was talking about the Secretary of State's office. They have been very helpful in all of the rules and ideas that we've been able to bounce off of the Secretary's office, and I really appreciate that. And I'd like to give a shout out to the County Clerks Association, who has supported me through all of the issues that I've had and has never wavered in their support of Pueblo County and the challenges that we have met. So I really appreciate everything that the association has done for us also. Thank you.
Unless someone else would like to comment, I think we'll close out with that. Thank you very much for attending. And if you have any written comments that you'd like to provide, we'll keep the record open until 3 p.m. tomorrow. Thank you. You don't want to write a final note.